Hello and welcome to Proof of Usability with Zach Herring. We're currently doing like a 10-day cadence where we talk to people in the blockchain and distributed web space. This conversation is a banger, I'm going to be honest. I really enjoyed sitting down and talking with these two guests, both from Protocol Labs on the Filecoin and IPFS teams, respectively. This is Jim Lee and Jessica Schelling. This is a great conversation. I think a lot of times whenever designers get together, they end up talking a lot about... You end up talking about kind of like shop talk. I feel like shop talk is what generally gets discussed whenever designers sit down. And there's only so many times that you can talk about Figma plugins and Gorilla user research and all of those. I think there's a ton of that out in the ether. You can watch that until your face turns blue. I think one of the things that I don't see enough of, though, is designers talking about the why of designing, which is what I'm really excited to get into today on this episode. To sort of take a step back from the tools that we use and talk more about the why and the how and the when of design instead, which I think is not really, these aren't conversations that we have often enough in the space, in my opinion. Really excellent conversation. I think I'm just going to jump into it. So without further ado, this is Jessica Schelling and Jim Lee from Protocol Labs. Crazy excited to have both of you kind of on the call. This is going to be really, really, really interesting, I think, both from the perspective, because A, you're both doing really different things within like the same product space, which I think is going to be fascinating. So why don't you guys just take a second to introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about your journey from whatever you were doing beforehand into crypto, into Protocol Labs. Jessica, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Jessica Schelling. I think theoretically my title is something like UX lead for IPFS at Protocol Labs. But being a startup, that means whatever you want it to mean on any given day and time. I did not come out of the crypto or D-Web space at all. However, I did approach this. It was funny because I wasn't even looking to make a career move, and then literally three friends of mine sent me the job posting for the role that I'm doing now, and they're like, hey, look, someone made a job for you. And when the third person said that, I ended up applying. But I did come out of a lot of work in really the identity and privacy space. I had been doing a lot of consulting and some tangential work, and then I'd also been at Harvard where we implemented single sign-on for the entire university, which was super interesting and got me both a chance to really dig deeply in the information privacy space, but then also just being, you know, in Boston and Cambridge, getting the chance to hang out with all of these people who had literally built the internet and going and hanging out at you know, identity ecosystem steering group meetings and going and going to local IETF meetings and just getting to know all of these folks and hearing about the original motivations and the high hopes and dreams and visions that these folks had come about all of this with in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And then hearing them talk about, you know, where we are today and, you know, some of it is, oh, this is great. We never saw this coming. And some of this is like, oh gosh, what happened? And the ability to be part of the next generation of that and to be able to do that from a very foundational perspective and then also to be able to actually apply my subject specific knowledge just in user experience and in large integrated systems was about the best thing since bread. So here I am.
How long have you been at Protocol Labs and IPFS? Was it 2 years?
About a year and a half, working on IPFS.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. And whenever you said you went to those meetups, was that pre or was that before you started working at Protocol Labs or was this like, oh wow. Okay, cool. So you were already really interested in kind of like the identity space and everything.
And just at a completely personal level, I mean, I'd left the Harvard Project and had been working in fintech, actually. And I was an annoying person in all of these meetings saying, well, what about user privacy? What about self-sovereignty of data? And they're just like, take off your tinfoil hat occasionally. That's not true. if anybody from that part of my life is listening, I did get to work with some fabulous folks, but to be able to move back into a space that was really just kind of synthesizing all of this and learning what I learned in fintech and learning what I learned in the insurance industry, and then just sort of suddenly all of this comes together in the perfect nexus. So it's a really interesting space to play in.
I agree. Cake, what about you? Where did you come from, and how did you end up kind of on the Protocol Labs teams?
Yeah, this is a really hard question for me because my career has been really, really scattered. So I'm also not from the D-Web space originally. This is my first foray into peer-to-peer. And I think by that extension, this is my first foray into crypto. In 2012, I was a WebRTC expert. In 2013, I worked on digital trading cards. In 2014, I was the first front-end hire for Patreon.com. And I built the front-end engineering team over there. After that, I spent a couple of years focused on long form writing and editors and application development design and mentoring. Then I worked at a company called Expo that does React Native. And so we did a lot of open source there and dev tools. So we produced some tools that people use to build mobile apps now. And then after that, I worked in gaming. So did a lot of research into worlding and object-oriented ontology and hyperobjects and how to create like dynamic worlds that are engaging, compelling. How do you like really compelling storytelling? And then I ended up here at Protocol Labs because I'm a longtime peer of some people. I think Protocol Labs reached out to me like 3 or 4 years ago. And I, at the time, was so invested in, I think, like poetry that it was like a different jump for me than...
That's a completely different headspace.
Yeah, exactly.
I would think. I'm not a poet.
and so like I think like I came here and, you know, my secret agenda, which is not so secret now, was really trying to focus on like, what's the human story for all of this like internet? Like the internet's probably the most precious thing to me in the whole world. I love it so dearly. I've been making websites since I was a kid. So for me, it's like, it's one of the best bridges to another human being. So how is that happening here? And also in like my design studies, reading like Frank Chimero and Kenya Hara, like how are we bringing this aspect of love and nurturing into the digital stuff that we build, and how are we bringing back romanticism? You know, like how do we dream big again versus like, you know, this determinism or fatalism that we see daily and in software? And I think the fatalism hurts people because it's like, you know, before people finish, people are already like cutting people short on what a project could be or what something could be. And I'm trying to like do like internet magic again. I want like people to feel like, oh, you know, everything you make, as long as you're connecting meaningfully to another human being, there's something compelling there. Don't let someone say, you know, it's not profitable, it's not something like that. And I think there's a way to have it all. I don't believe in a lot of mutual exclusivity. I don't think like, you know, you have to be all in on one thing. I think everything grows in all buckets. So yeah, I've been across the board. And I think if we are building the myth, which is the new internet, right? I think we have to really, really think about the actors in the network, which more so the human actors in the network than purely, you know, the programmatic ones.
That both answered my question and also gave me 1,000 other questions. I'm sorry, Jessica, I cut you off. What were you about to say?
I think Cake brings up a really, really good point in this, in that we are at a space right now where those of us who've been doing, you know, design, what does design even mean? Those of us who've been doing design for a while tend not to have come at this from a traditional background. You know, many of us who end up in this are on career number 3 or 4 or 5. I did not realize that I did. Somebody said to me once, many years ago, oh, so you're an information architect. And I said, what is that? And I went home and I ordered myself a copy of the Polar Bear book, you know, the the animal book on information architecture. And I went and I read it over the weekend and I had a religious experience. And I think, you know, what I'm getting at here is the fact that where this industry is right now as a whole, but particularly in these emerging spaces, is really hinging on the ability for people to do some really serious hardcore synthesis. We need poets, we need classical musicians, we need psychologists to be able to bring in the points from their specific disciplines to actually synthesize this into something that doesn't exist yet.
I agree.
The intersections between those things are where we draw innovation. It's not just one. I think like people tend to focus in one domain, but I think some of the benefit of having a design process is you kind of create this avenue for people to meet at where it's like, I have this intersectional skill. I think if we combine our understandings, we'll reach a new conclusion or better conclusion. So yeah, totally with you on that.
So can I, all right. So then I want to pose a question because I think that this perspective alone, kind of like this sort of it's a radical reorientation towards the person, right? And I think Kate, especially what you're kind of outlining where it's like, it's not worthless if this person is forming a connection with someone else. That to me is one of the most user-centric perspectives I've heard when it comes to building things. And so I'd love to hear from both of you as far as how you think about when you think about products, about building products in a space where there's stakeholders and I would say within the crypto space especially, but because it was kind of overly indexed on engineering talent, because it was such a technical, sort of early on, it was so technical and it required so much sort of knowledge share between a whole bunch of different technical people that it's really heavily indexed towards the engineering side, which is to say, God bless them, there's a high prevalence to just code first and then throw it out there and then see what happens versus like understanding that sort of like, there's like a kismet, an unspeakable sort of like connection that technology enables, right? Like in like the 90s between message boards, right? Like making friends that I had never met before in my entire life. But
and allow for that. It's not, unfortunately, it's not a direct answer. I can't say like do a thing to do this. I think it's a combination of things. I think Jessica might have some thoughts there.
Well, and Cake brings up something really interesting and really valid here. And there's the, especially those of us who come out of traditional product backgrounds, and especially those of us who come out of traditional product backgrounds in a very regimented, we've got some devs hanging out over here, and then we've got the designers over here on their Macs, and you know, and this very, yeah, go fix the thing and fix it ASAP and fix it within paradigms that we understand. That whole metaphor in this space so often completely falls apart. And that's actually a blessing. I think, you know, I think what Cake's saying about sort of the dynamics of misery is a really good reminder to not try to solutionize. I hate that word so much, but
it's the first time I've heard it. Solutionize?
Okay. To not try to fixate on the solutions for things, to not try to like, you know, to not try to problem solve ourselves into boxes, because we are living in this very, very wide open space right now. And if we immediately jump to here's the problem, here's the solution, traditional very product ways of thinking of things, we risk missing out on so many possibilities. Now this gets real, real weird, you know, like to be completely honest, because you can't really rely on the almost waterfall style way of systems design that we still do. It's let's decide a mental model. Let's take that mental model and turn it into an information architecture. Let's take that information architecture and turn it into user flows. Let's turn that into buttons. You know, like that doesn't even work anymore, because we're right now in the position where we're codifying the metaphors that are going to serve us for decades. And this has been the sort of mental shift I've had in this work in this line of work, is to be a lot more comfortable with really working in the flow, to be more accepting of the fact that we may be in situations where we want to iterate on our users, and we may not even be able to do effective user testing in a lot of ways, because who the user is still really open to definition. If I look at this if I look at some of the problems I'm working with right now from a developer-centric mindset, the directions I take are going to be completely different than if I think about the end users the end users I've gotten now that we didn't even have 6 months ago. And so it's very chicken and egg, and we have to, I keep having to tell myself, I may not be, you always hear, oh, you're so lazy if you're not doing the detailed research and the detailed field work. And sometimes that just is not even possible in this space. And so you have to find different methods.
There's like, 100%. There's two things that I think you both kind of sparked in my mind. I think this idea of like users who weren't there 6 months ago, to me is like one of the truest statements I've heard, because it is, I mean, it's crazy how this space has changed. I've only been in this space for 2.5 years, right? And to see it evolve from what it was in like early 2018 to what it is now, it's almost like we're seeing a crazy ramp up between the usability of it, and I mean usability in kind of like a holistic sense of like the things you can do with crypto now you were not able to do 2 years ago, or even 18 months ago, or even 6 months ago. And so I think that sort of like almost that like rolling redefinition of users is such a fascinating mindset to kind of take within building products in this space, that is one of the reasons I'm here. I got bored in Web 2 space for like, because it was like, how many times can you redesign like a logic flow? How many times can you redesign like, seriously? So,
yeah.
and the other thing that I really responded to between the both of you talking is this idea of misery. Like, there is such a thing. I think the base level understanding of UX, because it has usability in it, people tend to default to this idea of like, well, is it easy to use? Is it easy? And that's and that's not right. That's not accurate.
No, it isn't easy.
Right? It's not easy. I think that there's a, like, if you go in with that mindset and you like, if you gave someone with like that really like surface level understanding of usability, like, is it easy to use? If you said like, go design a gym, they'd remove all of the weights and they triple the juice bars. And they say like, I'm done. It's easy to use. You go to the juice bars, right? Like, there's such a thing as like healthy friction. And I think it's up to, I think it's up to the entire team with kind of this idea of like, what needs to be difficult to use? What sort of actions or what sort of behaviors within this space, like, do we need to like set a certain amount of friction around? Else we just end up designing junk food, which is like, I think why the state of Web 2 is the state it is because we've had such a focus on like, I mean, just like customer delight. And I'm using like air quotes, audio audience, for delight, because like, I think like it's such a cheap metric that you just end up addicting people to kind of an endless flow of content without like any sort of like, there needs to be more friction. there needs to be an association of misery and of like the full human experience when we're designing these products. So I really appreciate it. Like, kind of both of those statements, I think, really paired really interestingly. When you both think about sort of that rolling redefinition of users, is it a time box that you think of? Like, is it a time box? Is it just like kind of talking, like continuous communication? Like, is it sort of community work? How do you know when it's time to sort of revise that mental model that even you have, if not your team, have of the users that you're building the products for?
That is a really good question. I will start by saying, about this time last year, I was like elbows deep in what was sort of our foundational persona development. And we'd done some of this work in the past, but hadn't called them that. You know, we were a little maybe scared to call them personas. But having, you know, it's like, okay, so circa autumn 2019, who are our personas? And I sunk couple of months of off and on work into this and did a ton of interviews and arrived at our personas circa 1 year ago. That is totally different than it is right now. Obviously, those stakeholders are still incredibly valid, but we see this sort of, we see a very sort of chicken and egg thing. I mean, we were a year ago in some, focusing vast amounts of energy on certain types of developers. And by certain types, that could be your familiarity with DWeb. It could be your devotion to the cause. You know, are you a hobbyist, or are you going to build an entire business around this. It could be, what is the sort of thing that you're trying to build? Are you trying to build developer tooling? Are you trying to build user-facing stuff? You know? And when you've got a limited amount of resources, it's like, well, do you focus on folks who are building dev tooling to help other devs? Or do you focus on people who are building end user tooling? And the answer to both of those is yes, it's do everything. But you look at the case of both of those as constituencies. Folks who are building end user facing stuff are bringing in entirely new groups of end users with completely different requirements who then refocus our personas. Folks who are building dev tooling bring in completely new sets of devs who are completely unaware of what any of this is. And then that gives us a whole bunch more types of users and personas to consider. So the thing's going to be really, really, really cyclical. Mm-hmm. And accepting that, you know, accepting that you're going to do work, it's not throwaway work, but it's going to be real invalid, real fast, really does change your approach to this problem set as a whole.
I agree with that. I mean, like, I think when we do early stage products, we try to chase momentum. So we try to chase like what seems to catch fire, but oftentimes that can lead to dead ends as quickly as it leads to excitement. And I think mobility is kind of the key thing here. Like, we're at the mercy of market creators. We're at the mercy of like economics. We're at the mercy of like how things are commoditized, like what labor is commoditized and how they expect to work and how they expect to use tools too. And these always shift whenever people are financing different things. And so, like, you know, for example, I would love Filecoin to be used in the movie industry somehow, right? And so that output is just as complex of a system, as probably far more complex in a lot of ways than just, you know, what is perceived by the output. And so, you know, those dynamics change as movies change. And so you have to have that mobility to kind of be like able to change your assertion right away. That's why I say a lot of times in our product process, it's like no wrong answers. No, there's no wrong answer, just go. Because you'll have to change your answer frequently. And as you learn more, as you make more connections with different objects in the world, you know, you have to make new assertions.
And there's also another thing to keep in mind is that, you know, particularly in the case of IPFS, we're building something that is never going to exist to most ordinary human beings. You know, we're building a protocol. And that's relevant for two reasons. One, we're building for something that's the end game is to be invisible and ubiquitous. Like, nobody these days are like, I just built an HTTP site. Yeah. It's not a thing. And so you don't want to get too precious about who you are, because you're building plumbing. You're a bunch of copper pipes. Absolutely. And you're there to carry other people's stuff. And what that also means is that I can't, and I find this immensely exciting. What organization, what individual, what lady in a basement with an axe to grind on a topic and an interest is going to build a thing that is going to give us as the folks working on IPFS an entirely different focus? And so we are so driven by the people who build the tooling and the end user tools on top of IPFS that, you know, it's going to be a totally different landscape 6 months, a year, 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm. So that actually dovetails nicely into my next question, which is essentially, like, I think when people talk, I mean, again, to go back to this misconception, usability, UX design, product design, we often, when we think of that, we think of the pane of glass, right? Like representing the interface in front of you. But I think you're both designing experiences and protocols, which to me is A, both a really, really unique problem space, and B, you don't see a ton of, like, back to your animal book, right? Like, I don't think I could pull up O'Reilly and find like user-centered protocol design. I couldn't find anything like that. And so I would love for both of you to just kind of riff as far as like comparing your previous work, Web 2, maybe like more traditional product spaces. What is the same? What is different? Like, how do you think about designing the pipes, the brass pipes in which content flows?
Oh my goodness. It's a really challenging question. I think one thing that doesn't change is I think Jessica touched on the cycles aspect, which I think is like absolutely essential, and like having a meaningful cycle and being able to take learnings from each and be able to reorient and adjust. One of my favorite studies is, you know, a lot of us have watched a product called Notion kind of evolve in like the last 5-6 years. I've seen the code base many times. It's change dynamically each time. It just shows the amount of churn in ideas and where they were wrong every corner. And you can see that it's not just difficult in the labor itself of producing that code and that design, but also the personnel involved having to, you know, like, it's hard for that team to constantly, you know, there's a tax you put on for yourself when you're constantly, like, you know, testing against something that's so hard, which is like trying to get that adoption. So I think that process is here as well. It's just that here, there, as Jessica was saying earlier, in the protocol level, it's the ultimate hyper object. It's something you just cannot touch and feel. It's like climate change in some ways. Mm-hmm. You can bear witness to aspects of it, like the outputs, like HTTP is used for like APIs, that makes sense, right? But beyond that, like trying to understand this thing that's in everyone's computers globally that powers things behind the scenes, that is like the platform for the structure for anything and everything. That is just, yeah. I think the momentum is what really gives you kind of some evidence that things are working out in certain ways, but you know, it's not crystal clear.
And I will point out this space is two things. It's A, it's very new, and B, it's really hard. I mean, really, really hard. And I work with, I have the privilege right now, I am working with the most intelligent people I have ever worked with in my life. I love being the dumbest person in the room all the time. That is such a great feeling. But, you know, I'm working with people who are super specialized and, you know, the experts in the field, at this point, it's a nascent and enough field that to be an expert in a certain area is like that old story about people describing an elephant, and you can only describe the part of the elephant that you've got your hand on at any particular point in time. What we're trying to do as design people, as usability people, again, whatever that even means, is to try to unify some of that. And Zach, you bring up something that's really interesting in the sense that, like, we both have none of the metaphors and we have all of the metaphors. taking a new field like this, yeah, I mean, we as humans, we're pattern seekers, we're commonality seekers, and we're going to draw from existing metaphors in our life. And this is the point at which I inevitably bring up rich Corinthian leather. And you think about... and you think about the sort of skeuomorphism that was going down in the early days of either GUI-based computers, you know, the original Mac OS, or the metaphors that we were carrying into the internet. We were surfing the web. And, you know, these metaphors are so labored now. We're at the point, and I think this is something I have to keep reminding myself. You know, we're at the point where, like, there's that joke, there was a meme that was going around with, like, someone's daughter found an old floppy disk and said, "Look, someone 3D printed a copy of the save icon." And, like, we've got to that point where these metaphors have run full circle, and we can learn a lot by remembering, you know, however old we were when we first used a GUI computer. However, you know, I won't out myself. You know, I had an extremely slow modem and a Commodore 64. If then, you know, that's showing my age.
Awesome. That's so cool.
Oh man, it was the best. It was the best. But thinking about the amount of struggle and the amount of skeuomorphism that went into the metaphors, that went into the mental models of understanding things circa, I don't know, 1985 or 1994. And we're in that place again, and we have so much to learn from what we did and did not do well at that point in time.
I want to pivot the conversation slightly because I want to be mindful of your time. And I would love to kind of get sort of almost into the nitty-gritty a little bit about what you both are working on specifically. I don't think there's a developer in the D-Web / blockchain space that isn't at least somewhat familiar with Protocol Labs and with Filecoin and with IPFS. But like I said, this is this team, I think I was surprised at how many different teams I had met talking to Protocol Labs and how many different things you all had going. So why don't we just kind of take 5 minutes to talk about, like, specifically what you're working on and kind of like the focus, five minute pitch. Let's just kind of like talk about the products themselves. Cause then I want to sort of like continue this in kind of the direction of, like, let's say other people are building other protocols. How would they start to think about approaching it kind of in the way that you are? So first off, 5-minute pitch. Cake, why don't you go first?
Yeah, you're doing the real sexy stuff.
I'll try my best. So when I joined Protocol Labs, there was an evident need for a graphical interface. And so it was spec'd out by engineering leadership that, you know, we need just a GUI to use Filecoin and cover all the features, including auto-renew deals, payment channels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there came a point where I designed, you know, like the typical way of doing design, which is like just produce mocks and, you know, get everyone on board with those mocks and produce the product and then just ship it, right? And then execute on, like, whenever you receive bugs, just fix those without question. And, you know, that's the way to go about things. But as things evolved as, you know, our push towards the mainnet evolved, I started working with Pooja to rebrand this thing as its own product, as its own entity, and we called it Slate. And Slate is basically an opportunity, I think, to build Dropbox, Keybase, BitTorrent-like software out in the open where all the source code is available for everyone to watch and use and do whatever they want with. And the team from the genesis can be a global team with people from different backgrounds from all the world. So we had contributions from Nigeria, Morocco, and Canada, and all over the place. And so kind of, you know, building this product out in the open felt right in the mindset of like how to honor this new internet, right? Like if the internet's for the people and maybe anyone should be able to contribute to the client and, you know, use the client to do things that are part of their day-to-day actions. So we thought a lot about, like, I think I have a team of 6 core members right now. And what we do is daily experiments on just what would be fun for a human being to do on top of the Filecoin network. What would be like, you know, can I make beautiful visuals to share with my friends as like for jokes, even for laughs? Or can I, you know, maybe I'm an important data set person and I need my data set protected. Like, what kind of fun can we have? And so Slay is basically that right now. It's like, I think at 108 stars and people kind of just digging through the code, asking questions. I really deployed a no wrong answer approach, which is like, you know, if you want to contribute, go ahead. And some of my mentees jump in there and they try something epic and it kind of goes wrong. And I'm like, no, that's great. We learned a ton from that, you know? And I think so Slate is, and its design system is really to help people build on the Filecoin network where we are just driving that effort and making the mistakes for everyone to see. So, you know, they can call us fools or whatever, but at least, you know, we can share all this. And so not only is the product itself, the source code, open source, the brand book will be open source too, which is like a process that is not kept open for most people. Like if you spend money on a brand book, usually using that as like a way to win in the market. You're telling the market creator, we are the big player, but I think we're going to open source it all. So I hope, you know, oh my gosh, like the other day, someone who wasn't even in college did a commit that blew my mind. And it reminded me that there's people all over the world, you know, that they are passionate about these things, but there's not enough paths to participate and have fun in that way. So, that's Slate in a nutshell. I think
under 5 minutes. What's your favorite experiment with Slate that you've seen?
So, like this experiment led to people calling us Squarespace in a lot of ways. I think it was basically, you know, Dropbox, my thesis. Nothing is Dropbox. It's a phenomenal product. I've used it for like a decade, but I can't play with my files. You know, I really like, I have some core functions, like I can share them, right? And I can store them, right? And if I were to think of everything on a file storage, like that narrative, like that's all you really need if you're thinking about from like a deterministic perspective. Tell me the core essentials. But I think a lot of the internet is really for like connections. So like if you're connecting with other people, you need play, you need joy, you need expressiveness. And so we created a way to like, you know, I got a gig of files and I, instead of just giving you like the list of them, I put them in a collage. I put the Toronto Raptors on a collage and I shared that with a coworker and on request and he's like, whoa. And then I put a deep link on Drake. So then when you click on that deep link, you go to Monet paintings. So like, you know, this is all real storage, right? Like you're storing your paintings, like they're high res or valuable, but you know, like we're having fun and it adds more meaning to the whole process. It basically is like, you know, there is joy in this new internet. There is like something to be excited about beyond just like the technical mathematics and precision around like the protocol and et cetera.
Oh, that's so cool. Can you, I want to get a link and include that into the show notes because that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I'll give you a link later maybe. But I tweeted about it too. And we started creating ways to be like, well, what if we could right click any image and put it on the Filecoin network, you know, and start doing fun things like that. I think that like bringing out like that, it is something that's for everyone. Like the actions you think like breathing, like eating, like putting on the Filecoin network could be on the exact same level. Maybe. Maybe.
Put your breathing on the Filecoin network.
Yeah.
I like it. There's like some sort of health startup in there, I think. Jessica, why don't you talk a little bit about what you've been working on?
Yeah. And actually the segue to that is, Hearing some of the stuff that Cake's team is putting together, you know, and getting to play with this is amazing because to a certain extent, you know, if you think about IPFS is one of the fundamental technologies of Filecoin, part of our remit is to not get in the way of stuff like that. And that's almost a very sort of intentional, almost form of undesign because you don't want to box anybody in. You don't want to box anybody into a metaphor or a way of thinking about something. But on the other hand, you also have to give them some starting points. So from an IPFS view, my work's a little more meta, and I feel like I have like a fog machine running in the background as I'm saying this. Because, you know, yes, IPFS does have a core set of GUI tools. You know, we've got IPFS Companion, which enables you to use IPFS more natively within your browser. We're going to have native browser integration in the future. Watch this space. Ooh. It's going to get real, real cool. we are so close to so many good things, so many great partnerships. But so we've got tools like IPFS Companion that allow you to get closer to native browser integration of IPFS. You've got IPFS Web UI and Desktop. Desktop is an Electron shell around the IPFS Web UI, which is just giving you some very basic file adding, pinning, sharing capabilities. And this gets real interesting because, you know, you want to give somebody a very simple way to start using IPFS, but you also don't want to box in their imagination because so much of what we're building right now is not user-facing and it's never meant to be user-facing. So from a design perspective, you know, we're doing a couple of things. We are in the midst of enhancing those GUI tools, primarily Desktop Web UI and Companion, really for an onboarding focus. You know, we know that there are going to be so many people who are getting to know IPFS as Filecoin launches and scales, and we want to make their onboarding as easy as possible. But then we also just want to give them really good bare bones tools for learning how to use IPFS in whatever way they want to use. You know, maybe you just want to store and share files. Maybe you want to use this as an on-ramp to building tools on the D-Web. Maybe you want to use this as an on-ramp to building dApps that also include Filecoin. You know, there are so many things you could do with this. So we're almost intentionally limiting the solutions that we provide from a GUI tool standpoint because we want to unblock the people who are going to build things that are more amazing and interesting and weird and fun and click on drink and go to Monet than ever imagine. So that's part of it. The other half of it is really just as you're doing that, you know, even if you're not building user-facing tools, you can still apply design principles. You can still apply systems thinking. You can still apply design thinking methodologies to just about every area of everything. And this goes back to the idea that no matter what you do, if you bring in a design person and they will find a way to be incredibly useful. And The more you can unfocus yourself, the more meta you can make that. You're just like, oh, well, this month I'm going to concentrate on the design of organizations. I'm going to the design of communities. I'm going to help someone put together an RFP for a community marketplace or a forum or whatever. You can UX anything, mm-hmm. and we're doing a lot of UXing oddball things in IPFS.
Yeah, UXing, I mean, like, I think I think to call back to like the original part, right? Whenever you were like, I don't even know what information architect is. And then you read the description, like, oh, this is what I do. I feel like design is such a broad skill that we're going to constantly be inventing niches for people to specialize in. Because where you say like, oh, well, I'm a UX designer. Like for instance, like at Consensus, I've been a UX designer, but within, or a product designer or whatever, but within that time, like we've worked on governance design, we've worked on organizational design, we've worked on prioritization. Like there's so many different ways. I mean, to me, design is ultimately just an externalized creative problem solving process that you involve the people who need to have a say in that. Like that's really all design is. And so, and if you need someone, I think if you can do it all on your own, great. You don't need a designer. You can, if you can like build, launch and grow the product in such a way that like you're completely self-sufficient, awesome. But if you have to work with other people, or if your product's success depends on other people utilizing it, it's helpful to have a designer in there because they kind of act as that translate. It's almost like the compiler between all of these different perspectives and all of these different sort of ideas. Like you crush it into the design sort of space, and it suddenly normalizes the vernacular that we're all using to talk about problem X and solution Y. So I love that. I think that's such a fantastic call out. So,
I want to chime in real quick. I actually think IPFS is extremely well designed. Like, it is extremely usable. My experience as an engineer on top of IPFS and using the partner services as well has been nothing but phenomenal. I think it's a testament to how much work that's gone into it. Mm-hmm. I think the way that software draws connections to people around the world is a different problem. It's an anthropological sociology type problem that most humans don't think about so much because, you know, we usually generally focus on the space that we're in, but like sometimes it makes it seem like some things are not like, you know, we look at everything has to be Facebook scale to be good design, whatever. But in reality, there are a lot of really well-designed things out there. And I also would touch on that. I think anyone who thinks they're doing everything by themselves is actually not acknowledging all of the structures that other people have put along the way to make all those things happen. Right. And so I think it's better to probably for some people who think they're, you know, doing everything on their own, to really acknowledge that all the things that were put in place to like all the work that, for example, Slate is done. I think if I think about it, really like 25 plus people have really invested time to really even shape it. I could never in my life call this project my own. I think that's what it should be though. I think if more engineering teams that were really, really open about letting everyone come in and inviting the ideas of different designers and, you know, collaborators, I think a lot of projects would actually bloom a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Let's continue with that. How do you incorporate, let's say we're talking to teams that are just starting to build their stuff, like they're pre-seed, they're still, it's still kind of like an idea in their head. How would you start involving designers at that early stage, specifically for something maybe as abstract as a protocol or an experience or like kind of a multifaceted tool? How would you both kind of go about doing that?
I think it starts with breaking the ice and starts with, you know, asking the right questions. I think like oftentimes you'll hear from people in any engineering organization being like, wow, they were doing the same thing for months. Wow, they didn't even talk at all. And they were doing, you know, they were exploring the same topics and didn't even just like, you know, get to know each other. I think that's like where you start with the process and you start changing things up where it's like, actually, you know, the code I'm writing, I'm proud of it maybe, but you know, we're all kind of in this, like we should be sharing openly our process and learnings daily. And like, you know, starting that high touch communication between, you know, and you start finding out that, wow, like we have actually been more aligned than we were more aligned from the get-go and we just never really acknowledged it. And it's kind of just that like discovery phase, not in like, you know, looking through mocks online or looking through like product aggregators, but actually discovery phase, so like the people that are in your ecosystem and like just reaching out and being like, hey, like this is awesome. Mm-hmm. And then people being available for that. And I think you know, Protocol Labs doing everything in the open source space has made it so easy just to be like, wow, like this is all here. If I just dig through the source, it's all here. And I think it's a change from typical like market created startup ecosystems where it's like, I got to build my company in private. I got to launch, I got to win the market. So I don't want to share. right? So you see a lot of collaborators come from that space with the PTSD from those moments, being like, no, no, my work is secret. No, it has to be perfect. It has to be perfect. Sorry. You know, and I think that is not, like, we have to change our mindset in that if we want open thinking and kind of like more collaborative work.
And Cake's got a really good point about collaboration and communication. I want to add to that in the sense that tech has been for so long functionally siloed, like ridiculously so. And I mean, like I got detoured off and on for a couple of weeks in January about like what turned into a massive discussion on standardizing GitHub labeling. And yeah, this turned into like an org-wide discussion, which is actually super helpful. I mean, like I laugh, but now, you know, we've got an IPFS-wide set of GitHub labels and it is the best thing ever. But this started out as this conversation that I kind of ended up parachuting into, and people are like, well, what do you, you know, you design stuff, what do you have to do? What does this have to do with you? I was like, well, it's taxonomy, and taxonomy is IA, and that's exactly what I do. And the opportunities for understanding the overlap of people's skill sets, you know, the fact that, and it could be where the formal skill sets overlap, or it could just be, you know, you've got somebody who is a Go developer and also an amazing writer and is really great at tearing down technical topics, and you would never know that unless you opened yourself to those cross-functional opportunities. PL has been amazing about that. We continue to be amazing about that. It's something the industry hasn't been very good at as a whole for a long time, especially because often that means inviting in, I'm trying real hard to socialize this term tech adjacent, because it's like, oh, you're non-tech, you do marketing, or you're non-tech, you know, your community, your dev rel. Like, no, that's, you know, we got to get away from that mindset. And, you know, even if you're not coding, you wouldn't be here if you weren't some sort of nerd. Mm-hmm. And let's find out where we're all nerds, where that intersects, and where we can embrace the folks who are either tech adjacent for a living or who have a lot of tech adjacent skills. And let's make this happen. About who's writing the code. It's about who's making the things.
Yes. Preach.
For the audio audience, I'm doing like the slam poetry finger snapping thing. I just have myself on mute the whole time because I love that. So I think, like, and I want to be respectful of your time. We got 4 minutes left. So I would just say, so I guess my last question would be, I got a question and a mini question. So if you could wave a magic wand and have every team in kind of the DWeb/crypto space magically grok a design or research concept, what would it be?
This is a tough one.
I know. It's only it's hardball. What's that?
Can I wish for more wishes? No. Yes.
I think I'm going to go on a limb. This is kind of I don't want to say dangerous, but I'm just going to go on a limb. I think that the art of knowing how to serve someone, mm-hmm. like maybe taking a job as a waiter or waitress at a restaurant for just like, and knowing how to repeat that kind of like experience over and over again, regardless of the context. I think for people who, you know, we have this luxury of being able to be creative and our ideas being held up because of how difficult they are, but to actually walk through that full experience each day of like, serving someone, like working at an elderly home, any of those kind of things, just to have that palette, just like, I think that's what I want. I think, like, you know, I don't have anything. I think it's awesome that people are like really, really good at like tough things. I think it's just that it's really important to have that balance of like, when it's not about how optimal you are, but how well you can help someone with a critical need. I think just like, just to experience it, not to be told about it, but to actually have done it and to, you know, maybe to have some like heart in it where it's like someone they care about, right? Or like, you know, it there's forms of this, like writing your parents a letter or something. Sorry, it's a limb.
I love that. I think it's fascinating. That's a really, I mean, it's because at its core, it's empathy. It's like empathy for like the reality that most people experience on a day-to-day basis. It's kind of how I would characterize that.
Like the caveat is like the action of it specifically, like to have had mm-hmm. to act on the feeling, being consumed by the feeling is one thing, and like that's powerful. I think just the act of having to do something like that I think changes the dynamic a little bit more.
Don't apologize. I thought that was great. Jessica, what about you?
I think to add to what Cake says about empathy is a sense of awareness of permanence, because we're in a space, and I said this a little earlier, we're in a space right now where we're creating metaphors, we're creating terms of art, we're creating mental models that are going to stick for the next however many decades, which is awesome and terrifying. And with that comes an awareness, you know, yeah, we can still move fast and break things, fine, but we do need to do that with the awareness that we are building patterns that are going to be used for a long time to come in settings we don't even understand. And with that comes a responsibility for some intentionality.
100%.
Yeah. Immutability is a hell of a thing that I don't think we've really internalized yet in the space. Or else we'd be referring to each other as degens and that sort of thing.
Getting people to talk about, you know, think about the first time you had to explain to, you know, a friend or a family member how regular hosting works. And then think about how you had to explain to them what the cloud was. You know, now we're doing this again. And we have the chance to shape that language, to shape that way of thinking about stuff in ways that are useful, streamlined, elegant, heck, even inclusive. How great would that be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there's a lot we can do there. So let's go do it.
I love that.
I'm so with that.
I love that. That's so good. Last tiny question. We're at the hour mark. Best constructive thing you've read, watched, or listened to recently? It's something that has impacted how you think about making things. Cake.
Okay. I have a stack of this book I give to my mentees. It's Frank Chimero's The Shape of Design. And what I like about it is, like, I'm trying to push this new era of romanticism. So, like, how to be optimistic and see the things that you love in things versus, like, you know, constantly reducing reducing something. To this day, having a chance to reread it recently, I feel that book. And I highly recommend to anyone who just wants to see someone talk, like, write about how much they like something.
Okay. I'll add that link to in the show notes. I agree. I love his writing. It's fantastic. Jessica.
Okay. This is a toss up. One would be that I would tell everybody to go get on eBay and get themselves a copy of Todd Nelson's Computer Lib. Although those are real expensive. I think somebody's PDF'd that somewhere quietly on the internet.
We can put it on the Filecoin.
Put it on Filecoin.
I throw that out there for the sake of learning from the past. I throw that out for the sake of creating new concepts in a nascent field. But I'm also going to say, if you don't want to go drop a bunch of money on an eBay copy of Computer Lib, go learn a really new and alien thing. I've done radio for years. My New Year's resolution was to learn production. I went and I got myself a copy of Ableton Live and my head exploded. Go learn a new skill with new software, with new terms, with new tools that you hate and they're hard. And go back to square one and figure out why and bring that into your work.
I'm going to link to in the show notes one of my favorite essays about the beginner mindset, because I think to tie this back, I feel like this conversation is just kind of like constantly circles within circles, but to tie this back into Cake's point about empathy and like doing something hard and serving other people, I feel like beginner's mindset, if you stay within this like area of expertise, you kind of forget that vulnerability of learning something new and having dumb questions and like going like, how do I even get this camera thing to work in this 3D software or something like that, right?
I
think maintaining that, like constantly beginning anew, finding those things. I love that. I think that's a fantastic, fantastic call out, is like learning something new keeps you both humble and like kind of your own abilities and skill set. And also I think like kind of keeps you in the mindset of what someone in a completely new and completely alien sort of like space or context, what questions they have, because everyone, no matter what you're building, like if you're building something like for power users, there's going to be people for which that is a completely alien idea or completely alien context. So that's an amazing suggestion. I love that.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, so that does it for me. I want to thank you both. We're a little bit over. I apologize for going over. Thank you both so much. This has been an amazing conversation. I really
appreciate it. This has been so fun.
Yeah. Oh. So good to see you both too. Thank you for letting me tag along for this.
Thank you both for kind of bringing your A game. I think this has been such a good conversation. And I will include all the relevant links to your projects in the show notes. I will include your Twitter handles as well. People can find you on Twitter. Please reach out to them if you want to see more about what are the amazing things that Filecoin and IPFS are doing. Guys, thank you so much for your time.
That does it for my conversation with Jessica and Jim. Like I said, brilliant people. This was a joy to sit down. I wish we could sit down for another hour and a half. Not, I think, what you have the attention for. It's not honestly what I have the time for editing. So I think that's what we're going to call this episode, because I think we could have gone on another 3 hours. Again, check the show notes for relevant links, their Twitter profiles, the work that they're doing, etc. They're amazing people. I would definitely give them a follow if you haven't done so already. So this has been Proof of Usability. Another shout out to MetaMedia, who is publishing and cross-sharing this show under their media umbrella. They're starting an empire, everybody. Give them a look. Be sure to check out their weekly live stream, The Spicy Take. Find them on Twitch and Twitter at MetaMedia _. Also, check out the new show that they just launched, DeFi Download. Pretty killer. I've really been enjoying that so far. So I'm Zach Herring. I'm on Twitter at Z Herring. My DMs are open. So if you know of amazing designers, researchers, or product people in the space doing dope stuff, drop me a line. Let me know who I need to talk to. So thanks again, everybody, for listening, and keep middling, experimenting, and iterating. And I'll see you next time.